Hey James, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you very well.
How you doing?
Doing well.
Good man, good man. Well, listen, let's just dive straight into it. I can't wait to sort of hear all about what you're up to. I read a little bit about your business, your startup. So that's going to be really fascinating to dive into, particularly that space. So let me just do a quick intro. 3, 2, 1. Hey everybody, it's Ben from Startup Chats. Hope you all doing well. Today I've got James McWalter with me today. I'm really excited to chat about him because he's doing a tech startup with a clean sort of theme going on there. So James, do you want to sort of introduce yourself? Tell us about your business and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And appreciate the time, Ben. So I'm working on a company called Wolf D. It's still quote unquote stealth out on social media, et cetera. But in essence, what I'm looking to do, or what we're looking to do, is decarbonize food supply chains. And we're obviously in a world of ever kind of increasing issues around climate, and there's some massive opportunities in the space. And so basically I wanted to kind of combine my interest in sustainability and build a proper kind of data first business in that space.
Fantastic. How did you get to that point when you decided that's the sector you wanted to target?
Yeah, so I'm from Ireland originally, partly grew up in Ireland, partly grew up state in New York, but actually grew up on a farm in Ireland and then didn't do anything with that for many years. I left the farm in 2003, and haven't really looked back, and lived in London, lived in New York, I'm actually in Mexico right now. And all around, I was kind of working in tech and basically just, building products, selling products, all the kind of usual thing that a lot of people in the tech space do. And, I was kind of always had this niggling kind of emotion at the back of my mind that I wasn't really working on a product that I'd ever had a huge amount of passion for. I'd founded companies in the past. I'd been early employees at, exited companies in the past, but it was never something that I particularly cared about. And so it was about a year ago, I was, on a flight back from a friend's wedding in Thailand, and was thinking a lot about, what I want to do for the next, 10 years of my life. And I decided I wanted to build something that has, some real impact, but also is a company that scales and it's not just like a charity or something like that.
So, I mean, that sounds amazing, but just rewind back. So the farm, was that a working farm? Was that a family farm? So I'm just trying to figure out, how does a farmer's lad go from being a farmer to being involved in tech? It's quite an unusual good leap almost.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. So so it's a family farm. It's been in the family from about the 1870s until last year. So we sold it. And so that, a long time, and there was a lot of emotion obviously around kind of selling a family farm that was there for so long. And we basically immigrated to the States when I was 4 from Ireland. We were there for 7 years and we moved back when I was 11, and we moved back to the family farm where my granny at the time was living, kind of doing some basic farming on her own. Pretty small farm, 50 acres. And dad basically was then a part-time farmer doing kind of some odd jobs on the side as well. And it was primarily sheep, but we also had cattle for a couple of years. We had pigs 1 year. We would do turkeys every year. Just trying to get a little bit of everything. About 2 years in, after we came back, we converted it to organic. And my mother was head of the organic standards organization for Ireland for a couple of years. And so it's actually interesting. So we had dad was implementing organic standards for our specific farm, and mom was implementing them for the country. And so we'd have these arguments at the kitchen table, because there's a little bit of contradiction there. And so we worked on that. And, I haven't done anything in farming in a long time, as I mentioned, but the, distance always makes things look better. But you're getting up, you're involved with what they call pulling lambs, when you're birthing lambs in lambing season, all that kind of thing. Not a lot of sleep sometimes.
So different from tech world.
I learned a lot.
Yeah, definitely. Very, very, very different.
And honestly, I struggled a little bit. It was like small town life. I don't sound that Irish to Irish people because of those years living in the States. And so, I was a little bit of a foreigner in my own kind of country for those years. And you know, I was like, the big thing for me was to get out. And I was actually originally looking at academia. So I was on track to be an academic philosopher. I did a master's in academic philosophy and up in St. Andrews, and was going to up in Scotland, and was going to do that. And I was also, this is not for me. I was like, kind of getting fed up with that. And so I decided to just go work in London for a couple of years and just get a bit of real life experience in a well-paying job. So that's when I started working in sales at a fintech company there.
No, fantastic. So I guess that gave that initial grounding and experience of where you are now. So moving to the now and where you're, you know, where you're at, sort of explain about the business and specifically what you're trying to do on a practical level. I mean, with, you know, that high end level of reducing carbon footprint, but what does that actually mean?
Yeah. So what does that mean? I mean, you know, pretty much everything we do produces some sort of carbon dioxide, and like carbon dioxide in of itself is not an issue, right? Like you wouldn't want to breathe a room of it too much, but like, you know, you'll get out of breath pretty quickly. But it's more than just the pure quantities that we produce across all of our industries, all of our food, all of our agriculture. And so, you know, there's a lot of things thrown around there about, you know, 2 degrees warming, being carbon negative, all these kind of things. But in essence, all we have to do is a world which just produces less carbon. And that has lots of kind of positive elements. So in a world with less carbon, you know, the like a modern Tesla car is your minimum standard car, right? In a world of less carbon, you know, you have different types of ways of heating your home so that it's just less pollution inside the home, you know, fewer incidents of kind of lung disease and so on for children, all these kind of things. And I think we've done a really bad job just as a kind of climate community, whatever you want to call it, both on the entrepreneur side, as well as, you know, policymakers and so on, and actually describing like a positive case for what a post-carbon or low-carbon world looks like. Like, honestly, like it's absolutely brilliant. Like I've done the research on when these technologies are rolled out, and pretty much everything that people are doing today, it's similar, but it's quieter, it's cleaner, there's no smog. You know, you can see the skies when you're walking around some developing world country without it just being a little smog. And so this kind of like vision of that kind of future is what kind of inspired me to kind of look like, all right, where are there business problems that I can, with my background and this, you know, the skills I've built over the years and the contacts I've built over the years, build like a real business that is VC backable, right? Because I think that's a decision you have to make early on as a startup. Are you a lifestyle business, which are great and probably a better way to build wealth, or are you like a VC backable business that's going to be all about scale and, you know, has a 5-10% chance of actually succeeding? And because of the scale of the problem that I want to tackle, I decided I want to go and, you know, be that kind of fast growing potential business. And yeah, and then I just started, you know, like any kind of startup, I know you talked to a lot of other founders about like, how do you get to the kind of crux of the problem set? You know, one of the problems, this is my second company I've founded. I previously founded a company with my brother, and, you know, we made all the usual first founder mistakes there. We built more product than we had researched and talked to users and all that kind of thing. It was a personal training marketplace startup, an app. And we worked on that about a year, and that failed for various reasons. But this time around, I was like, I need to find the problem. I want to talk to tons of people in the food supply chain space, let them tell me their problem, and then only build enough product to get me to the next conversation, demo, trial, whatever it may be. And so basically, as I get, you know, make progress, you know, impress somebody, we just have our first customer now and about to sign our second, you know, then I just scramble to try and get, either I build it myself or I'm scrambling to get, you know, some of my advisors to help me build these things and then kind of move on from there.
So I think that's a cracking approach, actually. And I think it's actually probably a great thing that you had those failures, because clearly you learn from them and you pivot and you can take those experiences and move forward. So just explain a bit more about the, if you can talk about the first client and what you're specifically doing for them, that'd be great.
Yeah, so the first, I can't say their name, but they're one of the largest agribusinesses in the world. And, you know, basically what I'm looking to do is find the carbon at every point in the food supply chain, and then, you know, measure how much carbon there is at each point of the food supply chain, and then get that information into the hands of the people across that supply chain to make the lower carbon decision. And so if you think about the food supply chain, you have the farmers who grow the food, you have some trucks and logistics that deliver it, you have some processing and packaging plants, and then it's on the, you know, it gets to the supermarket, it gets to the restaurant, it's served, and we eat it and so on, or cook it or whatever it may be. And
it's a very complex process when you think about it, actually, isn't it?
Absolutely. And like some of these, you know, I think about like a McDonald's hamburger, like you're probably talking about 20 to 30 suppliers involved in just that hamburger, let alone, you know, the French fries or whatever else it may be.
It's crazy, crazy.
And billions of miles and, you know, probably 10,000 people involved in the creation of a single like McDonald's hamburger, just because of the scale of some of these food supply chains. It's absolutely massive. And once I started getting back into it, because, you know, going from a small scale farm background to like global supply chains, like it's quite a different language in many ways.
Yeah.
But like, if you look at that, the vast majority of the carbon, depending on the product, but about 70% roughly of all the carbon happens before the food leaves the farm. And there's various reasons for that. And so a lot of people think, oh, it's the trucking and the shipping that's, you know, very intensive, but it actually isn't. There's a couple of products like coffee that the trucking is like a larger percentage than the shipping. But for things like, you know, potato chips, like cereal, like all those things that are particularly grown in the West, grown in the likes of the United States, the vast majority of the carbon happens at the farm level. And the vast majority of that carbon is produced because of basically industrialized farming processes that destroy the soil and just churn up carbon and release carbon into the soil. And so this is like the big opportunity, because there's actually ways of farming that don't reduce your yield, don't reduce the amount of food you can produce on a given acre or given a hectare or whatever it may be, while returns carbon to the soil. It's called regenerative agriculture or soil health farming. It's very hot, you know, General Mills and a couple of these other kind of big companies are putting billions of dollars into research and how to kind of, you know, bring farming back to this kind of more regenerative manner. And, you know, not everyone loves this, right? Like the big companies that sell lots of pesticide and herbicide, like they are fighting against some of these moves. But in essence, if you can get farmers to work in these kind of more regenerative ways, and we're not talking little organic farms, like these can be 50,000 acre corn farms, corn and soybean farms, you could basically have the food, rather than being 70% of the carbon leaving the farm gate, being negative, like carbon. And so you could actually have food leaving the farm gate at negative. And so the, you know, box of cereal or whatever else may be on your shelves could be net carbon zero. And so that's what we're trying to get to. And basically the initial product is actually a chatbot, because I was at a chatbot company and we were acquired by Google back a couple of years ago. So I'm very familiar with that as a form of technology. And it's an SMS chatbot that interacts with farmers and basically finds out information about their farm, checks that information against some satellite imagery data that we're collecting in other ways. And then on the basis of that, gives them a quick recommendation and say, hey, to have the largest impact on your carbon, you should implement this specific practice. And that's what the initial trial that we're doing with this kind of agribusiness company is, you know, we're looking at, you know, a number of farmers. We're actually starting in Europe and then we'll go to the US after that. And that pilot will start in the next 2 weeks.
I've got so many questions that are whizzing through my head at the moment. I'm just going to try to do them sort of in rough order. So to begin with, you're focusing, obviously there's that, you know, the whole journey and that whole carbon problem you're trying to face. Your focus within the product, you're looking to focus within that one area at that 70% area so you can have the biggest impact. And then at some point, maybe look at the other 30% to see if you can tackle that area, or is it just that is your focus and I'm not even going to consider that area at the moment?
No, I'm absolutely considering the other elements, and also VC backup a company, you got to consider the whole thing, right? Like that's your argument in a pitch deck and whatever it may be. So yeah, absolutely. Interestingly, the other areas are generally easier because, you know, a lot of trucks have like a trucking logistics API. And so you can plug in the data sets from a lot of these other areas in an easier way. So I'm basically starting with farming because it's not just the largest, but it's also the most difficult. And that's where you can potentially build like a moat as well.
So in terms of the, I guess, who are you finding the main drivers for this change? Because like you touched on, I'd imagine some farmers don't want to change. They see it maybe as more hassle, another cost. You know, I've got a process, why do I need to change it? You know, I'm happy, stop being a pain in my side type thing. Is it driven by just some farmers and who want to do that change? And obviously you'll have some that don't. Or is it more driven by the brands that want to buy that produce? How do you see it? Was it both?
Yeah, so like the incentive structure of any, you know, what they call value chain, if you're putting on your kind of business guru kind of hash, like is something that's constantly fascinating to me, constantly something I'm thinking about. And honestly, like the technology I'm deploying today is very much off the shelf. it's the remixing of those technologies that targets, you know, specific incentives. Is that's how, in my view, you can build a business in this kind of space. And so there's kind of generally kind of three pressure points that are driving change in this space right now. And it's very dependent on geography. So in Europe, it's entirely driven by government regulation. So governments are saying, companies, you need to cut your carbon, and that's just the way it is. I'm actually less interested in that space because I feel like that'll take care of itself. You already have those strong incentives. And in general, the farming that I'm in, at the scale I'm interested in, is mostly in the United States and Canada, which doesn't have those regulatory pressures. And so what's happening in the United States and Canada is much more, you know, driven by shareholder pressure. And so the companies like McDonald's are now having their shareholders put pressure on their executive boards to reduce carbon from a climate risk point of view. Basically, you know, they're afraid of the threat of kind of future regulation. And you also have some very, very large asset managers, everyone from Yale University to, you know, the Firefighters Fund, who are starting to what they say called divest money away from climate intensive companies. They've already done that with coal. In a lot of companies did this, or a lot of divestment happened with coal in 2020. And basically everybody's looking like, look, you know, if we're a very carbon intensive company, like our share price might go down because of this divestment over the next 2 to 5 years. And so now all of a sudden it went from something that was like a sustainable kind of greenwashing, let's tick a box and let's look a little bit green and like, you know, have a nice picture of a sheep or something, to something where, oh, you know, if our share price goes down, like everything like negatively affects that across our large organization. The third piece, which is generally what people are, the third pressure point, which a lot of people think is like the primary one, but is actually less kind of, you know, I suppose less than the other two, is consumer demand. And so we do have, you know, generation, you know, I'm 36, you know, squarely early kind of millennial, and like, you know, we love our, you know, oat milk and, you know, sustainability and all those kind of things. But generally we don't actually do as much kind of, you know, price pressure with our actual spending habits as you'd think. But we are doing some of that. And so the kind of third pressure is you have sustainability first brands like the Oatleys of the world, you know, do their oat milk. They're starting to explore these kind of carbon negative products. And so we actually already have some carbon negative products that are, you know, advertised as, you know, carbon negative or carbon zero in New Zealand and Australia. And so you're starting to see the large companies in the United States and also these kind of mid-sized sustainability first brands be like, oh, we could actually charge 20% more for the carbon zero thing. And now all of a sudden you've margin for everybody else to play with.
That's really interesting, isn't it? When you actually start analyzing it, where those pressure points come from. Mm-hmm. Because it isn't just, you know, it's a multitude of things, isn't it? Multitude of layers. And it's something ultimately, like you touched on, consumers are starting to demand it, want it. Mm-hmm. And that leads then onto, you know, the way a company wants to position themselves as a brand. And then obviously that affects their share price. And it's all a whole big process. But of course, there's the regulatory side as well, which I didn't consider, but you're certainly right in terms of Europe. But I imagine that US, North American market is huge, and a good one to start with, certainly.
It's also where the capital is, right? And again, you got to think through like how you're going to build this. And so I'm looking to get to a certain level of monthly recurring revenue, not that much really. And then I'm going to raise some capital. I've already talked to, you know, a host of investors, and it's a very hot space and everybody's very excited and so on. And honestly, I could probably raise some capital today, but the valuations I was quoted were, you know, it's amazing, like an extra $1,000 a month in revenue will double your valuation. So you may as well go get that $1,000 a month.
Just hold out. Yeah.
Exactly. But I suppose one thing that might be helpful for like, you know, people who listen to this, like all the things I'm talking about, I knew none of that July 1st, 2020. Like I literally knew nothing. I left my previous role at a company I was very happy with, which was in a completely different industry in the market research space, on July 15th, I think it was. And everything I've said is through reaching out, cold messaging people on LinkedIn, asking them for 15-minute research calls. And so now I've talked to like probably upwards of 250 people across academia, like large company, sustainability departments, and everybody, and just be like, tell me your problems. And every time you learn a little bit more, so your questions get a little bit better. I suppose it's kind of similar to, you know, podcasting and other kind of areas where you're doing a lot of interviews. But I suppose like one of the things, you know, I'm obviously super passionate about like climate and all this kind of thing, you know, and I'll always evangelize for it, but like, you don't have to be an expert in climate. You don't have to be an expert in any of these things. You just have to have a willingness to put yourself out there and ask strangers questions, and then like a willingness to be curious and kind of learn.
Definitely. I've always said no question is ever a silly question. So sure. you know, not asking the question is actually the biggest, you know, mistake you can ever make. So get back to the product itself. Again, I'm just fascinated in terms of the practicalities of it. So is it a web platform? How does it, you know, the farm on the ground, you know, I know we've sort of dumbed this down a bit, but say small farm, what happens?
Yeah, so the farmer needs to learn, right, about this chatbot, right? And so basically, the way we're deploying it in this first pilot is these large companies already have an existing relationship with farmers. They're getting sent through marketing emails or other emails a QR code and said, hey, do you want to be part of, you know, carbon tracking for your farm? And there's all these benefits if you do so. Scan this QR code. They scan the QR code, and then actually we're using WhatsApp for Europe, but they're into an SMS conversation or WhatsApp. And it's basically a chatbot that I built in Twilio that asks about, you know, 8 to 10 questions. And on the basis of that, we can triage the farmer and say, okay, this is a farmer that's really suitable for some of these kind of carbon sequestering practices, or less suitable, or they've already implemented them. And unfortunately, they've actually done the good thing and they kind of get negatively dinged for that. And on the basis of that, we can then send them just on those kind of 8 to 10 questions. I have a little bit of machine learning and AI stuff going on in the background. Based on where that farm is, the soil type, the weather, all those kind of things, we can give them a basic estimate and say, hey, there are 50 things you could do to sequester soil carbon. This is your number one thing you should do. And this is the effect it'll have on the cost for your farm. And the entire interface for the farmer at this point will be just that chatbot. They just start talking to the chatbot, nearly like a personal assistant. All of the kind of heavy lifting is being done on the back end. The reason we selected the chatbot as a SMS and not an app or not a kind of web interface is basically because I'm trying to build things, or we're trying to build things that meets the user where they actually exist. And a farmer just lives, you know, in a tractor outside. They always have their mobile phone, exactly. They're always driving around. And, you know, an SMS is the lightest way to continuously kind of interact with farmers. Farmers today are actually quite sophisticated, especially in the United States. Like, they have a lot of dashboards, they have a lot of these other things. And so while I eventually want to get our data to be an API into these other systems, I don't want another dashboard, another app, another cycle, if we can avoid it, for kind of farmers to go through. Now, we have built like a set of dashboards and some data kind of elements for the large agribusiness who's actually looking to deploy the technology so they can see the answers and all those kind of things. But the actual use case is going to be very light to start.
I think that's a cracking way to go about it, actually. It's almost like a, you know, it's the MVP, isn't it? It's giving that farmer the absolute minimum they need. Effectively, you're giving them the information to make that change. I guess the question is then, what happens next, which we might come on to, but ultimately it's getting that conversation going, it's getting that education going, isn't it, from with the farmers, who are obviously the crucial element to this whole 70% of the carbon. Right. So at this stage, it's getting that buy-in, isn't it, that communication, that messaging, and delivering them the answers, so which is great. And I can see that could be easily adopted. There's not too many barriers. You've got your mobile phone, like you said. Yeah, why wouldn't you? The question then is, what happens next? How do you encourage them to actually make those changes?
Yeah. And also make money, right? Like, you know, it's always kind of a challenge. So the making of the changes, basically there's a couple different ways that you can kind of implement the changes. And so the reason, like this product, even though the data collection, data interaction is with the farmer, they're not the buyer, or I'm trying to avoid as much as possible the farmer being the buyer. I'm looking for the large agribusiness or some form of like food supplier that sits one layer up from the farmer who aggregates that supply to be the buyer, because there's a couple of reasons. First, they have more ability to spend, like to buy. They already have like a lot of these monopolized kind of agribusinesses in the United States. They already have you know, a lot of platform tools that farmers are already using. And so they are also channel partners. I don't have to build a massive sales team to try to get to 2 million farmers when I could just try to get to 20 agribusinesses, and then you get access to those 2 million farmers that way. And so basically the data that we're collecting will be used alongside all the other data that the farmer is digesting to just make the less carbon intensive decision. And so, you know, they're already using some farm planning tool. We've now collected additional carbon data, and that data will then enrich the farm planning tool data that they're already using to manage their farm to be lower carbon, and, you know, and be very kind of obviously like, look, you know, you did this way last year. If you do it this way, your carbon will go down 50% and your costs will go down 3%, but your yield will go down 1%. And you're gonna have that very kind of clear trade-off. Like, this is what would happen if you go this direction. And then the farmer may or may not do that, go that direction. If they do the thing, they say, hey, we did the thing, right? Aren't we great, right? We should get rewarded for that, either by the buyer up the supply chain. At this point, you now need to verify that they actually did something. And this is where some of the other techniques come in, and it's primarily satellite imagery. So I don't know if you ever talked to anybody who's using satellite imagery as part of their products or their startup.
No, but no, not at all.
It's an incredibly, and you know, even if you don't know a lot about it and you're a potential founder, like, look into how cheap and available satellite imagery is and all the cool things you can do with that. Basically, it just in the last 4 years, like, things have dramatically changed. It's very cheap. You can basically get monthly data for a couple cents an acre. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that a lot of the kind of machine learning models or even just manually spotting things, a lot easier than what it used to be. And so we're going to use, or we're using, satellite imagery to verify, because you can look at the farm, right? And every, you know, like, satellite imagery is like free data, right? You can look at anybody's farm, any, because it's just publicly available, or you can, you know, buy from a kind of satellite provider like planet.com or similar. And you can basically say, hey, you know, farmer, you've opted in, you said you're going to do these things, you implemented practice X, and we can see that you did implement practice X on this date. And we are adding that into our calculation, and then we'll give you a new recommendation and say, okay, you got this far, and this next thing will get you even further, and so on.
And is this when you start building out a platform? Or do you plug into other platforms that already exist?
Yeah, so it's and that's a good question. So the, you know, we can get, I suppose, into some kind of business philosophy, but, you know, I think a lot, and I'm very driven by people like Ben Thompson. Any listeners, he writes a Stratechery blog about, when you think about like building a business, especially like a high tech business, there's a lot of moving parts. You know, what are the areas that you want to kind of integrate, right, and own in-house? And what are the areas you want to kind of, what they call, modularize or let other people do? And, you know, a classic example is like, if you're going to build anything technology right now, you're using something like AWS or Google Cloud to host it. You know, so you have basically chosen a modularized solution, right? You're not going to build an AWS in-house, right? Rather than use AWS, you decide that it's better to use these off-the-shelf tools. And so when I'm thinking about, you know, you have a couple different steps. You have data collection, you have data processing, you have this decision layer, you have the data presentation layer, you have certification that comes later. You know, which parts do I want to do in-house and which parts do I want other people to do around me? And where is the most amount of value as you integrate different parts of the value chain? And so I want to do the data collection, I want to do the data processing, and I want to do the kind of decision, you know, the recommendations and decision making piece. I don't want to be the kind of display layer, right? I don't want to be the, I suppose to your word, like the platform that does all the other things. Now, there is a lot, the data processing element behind the scenes has a lot of complicated things from satellite imagery. We actually built a physical sensor to verify some of the satellite imagery data as well. But again, that should all be kind of below the hood and basically stacked within this kind of data processing layer. You know, I'm not trying to build, I suppose, a platform that other people can build on top of. I want to be an API that goes into other existing systems that are basically can be modularized around my data point.
And presumably those systems exist already.
Exactly. So these are systems like, you know, even CRMs, like ERP systems for supply chain management. I found out recently about a company called Trace Gains that do sustainability tracking across the supply chain. And reached out to them the other day about like potentially working together, because I don't want to be a software platform that does all those things. I want to be the best possible data set that enriches all these other software platforms for carbon data. Yeah.
No, fantastic. That's really good. try not to be too many things. It's just really getting really good at what you do. Sure. And dominate that space. Are there other players in that area, or is this something that has not really been done? Or
it's interesting. The soil carbon kind of sequestration space. There are a few players, but they're specifically looking to build soil carbon marketplaces. We, you know, everybody, I suppose, when they're trying to, you know, buy a flight on BA or Delta or whatever, you know, sees an option. You want to offset your flight, you know, X number of tons of carbon, whatever it may be. And so that's, there's a lot of marketplaces about how, what it means to offset carbon. So you can plant some trees, you can change farming practices, is one that's kind of emerged. And so there's a couple of companies, Indigo Ag and a company called Nori are the two big ones who are doing kind of selling carbon soil credits on behalf of you know, farmers and so on. And so there's a lot in that space. I have some kind of, I suppose, philosophical differences with their approach, because in my view, the farmers' pressure is going to come more so from the people who are buying directly from them rather than some third-party marketplace in terms of sequestration. And so, you know, I'm happy those companies are doing what they're doing. I actually know some of the founders at some of those companies pretty well. And, you know, it's a large enough problem, I think, the space for all of us. But I'm definitely taking a slightly different tack and focusing on the supply chain itself.
Oh, fantastic. In terms of, you know, when you're starting to model out the business and how it's going to work, how do you even begin to think about monetization and the revenue model? I mean, I wouldn't have a clue how, you know, what you're doing, where you'd start. You know, what's it worth to these industries, these businesses? I guess that's probably the starting point, is how much is that pain worth to reduce it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, and it's not just the pain to reduce it, right? Like, I'm basically
the incentivization, isn't it?
Yeah. But I have to basically add enough margin to the whole process that my small slice is not like the big line item either, right? And so, you know, again, like when I went into this, it's like I have to find an idea and an application of a business model that can basically get to 75% plus margins, because if not, it's not VC backable anyways, right? So like, you know, it can't be something where I'm like 15% margin and, you know, fighting for every sale or making up in volume, right? Like Amazon or something. Like, it's just not going to work in this space. So the first pilot, like, that is a paying client. I can't say specific numbers, but it's in the kind of, you know, mid to high four figures for not that many farmers. Because, you know, in essence, like, people should, like, the client where you can, even in a VC backable space, if the client will pay you to build, like, always try to do that. You know, I always try to ask, like, hey, can you, you know, will you pay for this? And especially these large companies, they will answer in a slow way. But the answer, if they say yes, they will pay for it. Like, they actually prefer to pay for it, because then it justifies actually doing work internally for themselves as well. And so what I'm looking to do right now is basically monetize. So this first pilot, it's just monetizing the data collection as a methodology. So like just that form of data collection. And it's actually like, and this is why you have to be focused, right? So this company, if this goes well, they would probably want to use this kind of chatbot methodology for non-sustainability purposes. They want to use it here and here and here and here. And like, I could build a very, very nice lifestyle business just servicing this one or two more companies doing that, but that doesn't align with the kind of, you know, the mission and goals of what I want to kind of work on. And so, you know, you mentioned being disciplined earlier in terms of product offering. You also have to be disciplined in terms of what you want to build. And so that's one aspect,
making especially sure when clients start saying, oh, can you do this or can you do this, and you can sort of go off on a tangent, can't you?
And that's why I think, like, really, and I know it's like kind of nerdy, but like getting with a pen and paper and just mapping out, like, you know, there's a reason I'm not going to build 20 dashboards. And like, when they ask for the 20 dashboards for the farmer, like, are you going to be, you know, have the, because otherwise I have to hire a designer. I've got to hire all these people, right? Like, and it's, nothing's cheap, right? Like, they'll be like, oh, I'll give you $100,000. I'm like, it's going to cost me $2 million to build out the team to justify all that $100,000. And so, and again, sometimes you'll do it. Like, it might make sense because you know, you're also trying to learn, right? And so if an opportunity came that aligned with those kind of goals of decarbonizing the food supply chain, that was, had nothing to do with chatbots, like was a type of deployment that I could spin up quickly, I would move like this, you know, a client willing to pay. But it, again, it has to kind of align with the other things that I've already put in place.
No, very, very much so. Nice. Sounds very exciting. So I guess you've got a first client, so technically you've launched. Mm-hmm. What was that process? I mean, I know we've talked a lot about your business and I really wanted to really get under the hood to understand it, because that's really helpful. And I think it's really interesting for the audience as well and fascinating to learn. But when you were starting to, you know, think about the launch, what was the sort of phases that you went through in terms of that? Did you have a launch date set, or was it a bit more sort of you went with the flow depending on how sort of, you know, development went in terms of developing the bots? Yeah, what did that look like?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. This is I don't recommend this particular early path because this is somewhat unique, but I actually was speaking to investors specifically about the product before I spoke to enough users. And basically I got an investor meeting with somebody just randomly through a connection, and I had to scramble and like come up with a product, right? Like 2 days later. And basically this is what I did. And then they loved it. They were like, oh, this is super cool. We want to see some people using it.
Was this the idea?
This is the idea. Yeah. This is what
I did. So literally you scrambled within 2 days. You go, all right, man, let's do this.
Yeah. This is like August 5th or something of 2020. So you know, 4 or 5 months ago. So about 3 weeks after I quit my previous job, I was doing all these research interviews and all this kind of thing. And so it was, you know, I spoke to this, threw together a quick, ugly pitch deck, walked through. And, you know, because I worked at a chatbot startup, I've been involved in selling data sets. Like, you know, you're just kind of going to the synthesis of the things you've already done before, yeah. Farming background, yeah. All that kind of thing. And they were like, oh, this is super interesting. Like, go show me that a couple of people use it and there's potential for an investment. So I was like, okay, great. And then I started, now I had like a deck. I had something, like, even though nothing was built, I had a couple screenshots from Twilio, I had, you know, a couple of different things. And so I just basically just got on LinkedIn and just started, you know, sending tons of people messages, like connection messages, where you say, hey, I'm James, I am, you know, in the early kind of stages of research for building products to decarbonize, you know, food supply chains or whatever your business does. Do you have availability for a 15-minute research chat? And you sell out 100, you send 100 of those, two said yes, right? Like you're only getting a couple percentage return, and like every morning, yeah. And right now, like after this call, I'll send out 50 more requests on LinkedIn. I'll get my one response, right? Like you just gotta churn, right? And so those few people, this particular agribusiness that I ended up kind of working with, I probably interacted with 30 people at that company before I got to the right person who was incredibly excited. I got on that one call, they were like, this is exactly what we've been looking for. Can I bring in our head of digital transformation and like all these people on a proper demo? I was like, yes. I was like, can you, you know, let's do that next Wednesday. He's like, perfect, like a week from now. And then I spent a week building a demo, right? And like spent the weekend kind of looking into Twilio and looking at best practices and all this kind of thing. And like any first demo, you know, if they ask more than 3 questions deep, it's gonna break. So like, you know, you gotta kind of manage that to a certain extent. And they loved it and kind of went from there. And again, every time I try to like get to the next step, you're learning and you're saying, okay, what isn't possible. And I try to drown the user with, especially large enterprises. Small companies don't do this. Big enterprises, I love to drown them with like sales collateral, screenshots, all those kind of things, because this is what they do with when they talk to Oracle or some of these big, you know, Microsoft, whatever it is, like they've got tons of documentation. It's like a comfort, you know, it's a comfortable space. It's like a comfort blanket to have like all this documentation. And so, you know,
small businesses hate that.
Yeah. And I just take I'll take the deck and I'll just screenshot the deck. You don't have to get all fancy in Figma or anything. Just, you know, cause like the being ugly is less bad than not having it at all. And so just sending that through. And I love GIFs as a demo, like use case. So a 10-second GIF of a farmer interacting with a chatbot, just the chatbot window, like that has been very compelling for companies. And then once I found, oh, there's actually at least one company willing or interested, this is before they decided to pay for it. But then I was like, all right, now, you know, I can start sending out a different type of message that's more specific. And then you kind of keep iterating from there.
You know what? I've heard software companies, old school software companies, sure. Basically did exactly this, where, you know, they'll have an existing client and talk about an idea, and the company goes, yeah, that's great. And they basically pay, you know, the software developer company to develop it. But of course, then the software company owns that right and sells it on to then the other companies and the other companies and the other companies. But the whole development cost was funded by that original client.
I think it's such a great way to get started. Like it's, you know, often there's an existing relationship, you know, like I think it's so hard to start something. you have to leverage everything you possibly can. Everybody has like dirty little secrets that like, it's like, oh, it's just, you know, I worked on it for 2 weeks and all of a sudden it worked. You know, like I'm currently living in Mexico and that like massively like reduces my cost of living. I split a very, very, you know, cost-effective personal assistant with my wife down here. And like, she sets up a lot of things for me. I still do all the outreach myself because there's elements of that that are important to do as a founder at the beginning. But like, these are the things that like add up to actually getting something very difficult to work.
No, definitely. And just rewinding back to that, sure, that initial phase when you're sort of trying to get off the ground and you're speaking to people, it sounded as though it was a bit of a snowball effect, which sort of just kept on growing, but almost those steps were the right steps to take. You know, you're speaking to the right people before you did too much work. You got the validation from that audience. You then got more validation. They helped you, I guess. Did they fund that first phase of development, that first company?
They'll cover the costs for those few months of work. Yeah.
Fantastic. So then in a way, you've not only developed the product and it's been funded, so you haven't had to get, you know, use your own capital or get investment.
Sure.
You get validation, you know, and you've got that first user case. So then I guess it's easier then to leverage to that next, you know, possible clients and expand upon from there. So no doubt that there probably wasn't, I'm guessing, one moment of going, right, yeah, we're out here, we're launched. It was definitely almost an organic process, by the sounds of it.
It definitely was that. I think B2B and B2C are very different beasts. Like, I think a B2C, I'm selling to consumers, the newest, coolest fitness app, whatever it is. I think launches are really valuable and powerful in that space. You know, you get your pre-list, your beta list, there's going to be a big launch, you can have a bit of a splash. That's a marketing move anyways. B2B, I hate B2C. That is not my comfort zone. I've tried it in the past. I'll never do it again.
It's hard,
but like the upside is so amazing. And it's very appealing to a lot of people, but like B2B, like that's my heart and soul. And so in the B2B world, all you need is one person to say yes to make a business, especially if you're targeting the largest clients. And like, you can select your clients. You know, like Seth Godin, I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with, he has a startup school, which is like a series of podcasts. And he talks about how like, when you're starting a business, you know, if you think about a Monopoly board, you can pick, you know, unlike a Monopoly board where you're just randomly getting on different squares, pick where you want to build before you start building it. Like, do you want a VC backable company that works on using technology? Do you want to service tons of small, like up and coming startups as your clients? Or do you want to service the 20 biggest companies in the world? Like, pick, kind of decide that to a certain extent early. And then like, you're not going to end up in 2 years time being like, oh God, we're servicing a client we hate, right? And so I knew I wanted to work with larger clients in general. That's the space I'm kind of interested in. And I knew that those downsides, right? The sales cycles take forever. You'll talk to 100 people there before you get to the one person who like really buys in and loves it. And a lot of those people like hate working at big companies, and so they can suddenly leave, right? So there's all these elements of working with big companies are negative, but if you get them, they never cancel. You know, they can get to $1 million contract in 2 years with some of these big clients, right? Like, it's phenomenal. And so, you know, are you happy with the long upfront cost for the incredible benefit on the other side? And basically just make those decisions, because the other way is great. Like, find 200 like small to medium companies to buy your HR software. Like, there's a lot of different ways to approach that as well. And if you prefer working with small companies, they're more exciting, they're more interesting, they love talking to new vendors, all that kind of thing. It's just a different world and you have to make those choices.
No, I think that's a fantastic point to bring up and actually help, you know, anyone listening about starting a business to have that focus before you even start doing anything. And you touched on this early on when you started talking about, you know, I wanted to, you know, take that time to think about what did I want to do? What space did I want to get into? And it's interesting how all of those past experiences from the farming to previously working on chatbots have sort of all been brought together, including your desire to make an impact on this world. It's really fascinating how these sort of things in your life sort of come together.
Sure.
And almost hopefully build that perfect storm or opportunity.
Yeah. And look, I think I've been telling a very positive story, and it is like, that's the other thing I just wanted to mention. Like, you know, I'm not a quiet, you know, shy person. But like, I, you know, there was a couple of days in September, I was looking at potential co-founders and somebody I was really excited by, like that didn't work out. You know, I had a couple bad days. Like, what, you know, am I, should I even be doing this? I had a moment over the holidays, you know, like just before New Year's, being like, God, it's so much easier just to go get a job again. You know, like I just wanted to mention that I don't think I'll ever, you know, not found companies, because like for me, at least the positives, you know, outweigh the negatives. But those negatives, when they fucking hit, like, sorry, I don't know, I'm supposed to curse on this podcast, but when they hit, like, it is really, really incredibly tough. And like, I think it's really important to have identities outside of the work you're doing. You know, a very supportive family group, very supportive wife, you know, I got a dog I can walk every day. Like, and I think it's super valuable and important. If you're going to start something, make sure you have a hobby or a family network or whatever it may be that you can rely on and not talk shop all the time.
I think that's very true, because I think, again, it doesn't get talked about a lot, I think, in this space or some of the startup spaces, where it's all about the hype and, you know, the excitement, yep, which is great. And it is incredibly fun. But I think, you know, having that strong foundation is so critical, because like you just touched on, you know, you are going to have those moments of huge pressures, huge stresses, huge, you know, problems, which gives you sleepless nights and causes, you know, a huge amount of anguish. So you need to have almost quite a level sort of, I guess, psyche that you can deal with those ups and downs without getting too crazy either way. Right. I think that definitely helps. But all those things help with that, like that good support network and, you know, your family, your friends, and things like that. So I think it's so true. And the other thing, I think, which we don't talk about a lot, and you touched on it, is actually being a founder of any business is the most lonely job in the world. Yep. You know, because it is on you. And until you're in that world, you know, as an employee, you've got no concept. You know, yep, you just get your paycheck and it's like, you know, and you do your job and you go home and you know, that's it. Or if there's a problem with the HR department not paying your bonus, you just get annoyed with that, but you don't necessarily understand why there is a problem. It's a very lonely job.
Yeah, and especially like solo founding, like, which is basically what I'm doing right now, it, you know, you don't even have the co-founder, but even when you have the co-founder, like, you still have to have a single person as the final decision maker, even in a 50-50 equity split starting, you know, founding team. Like, so it has to be a CEO. Like, you know, you still need a way to kind of finalize decisions. And just that little gap, even in a co-founding team, is lonely, right? Mm-hmm. And like, you know, I've been at various stages. I actually have a mastermind with two other kind of clean tech founders who are at very similar stages. The three of us are friends, and we kind of meet up once a month and have those kind of very kind of vulnerable chats and all this kind of thing. And, you know, one of them had very successful exits. And it's amazing, like, you know, the pressure changes, but it never lets up, right? Because all of a sudden, you know, oh, you've got 200 employees and all this kind of thing. And
it's
more pressure. Like, those 200 people all have families, and like, you can't let them lose their jobs, right? So
100%. It's a funny one, isn't it? But I think, you know, I think if you enjoy it and you start it and you enjoy it, I think it's huge rewards, because it's just, you're passionate about your thing and you're trying to make a difference, and it's not work, despite all these, you know, these pressures that exist and those lonely moments or even that self-doubt. But I think it is the most rewarding and funnest journey you'll ever do, is actually starting your own business, without a shadow of a doubt. But I think it's just, if you can get that foundation right where you've got stability, you can go and lead a crazy entrepreneurial life and go for it. But it definitely helps.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
So getting back to this VC bit, because I'm quite interested in that side. Did you find, my thinking would be that was way too early to even speak to a VC. Because I guess, you know, again, you know, I think a lot of startup founders think, oh, I'll go and get a VC and I'll get loads of money, and then it's not that hard to do, and then I go and build the next Facebook. More often than not, as you know, they want it almost to be a proven concept, and have customers and have revenue and all the rest of it. So how did that, I guess, what was that decision to actually go and speak to that VC first? Did you think to yourself this was too soon?
Yeah, Yeah, no, it's a great question. So again, I didn't have that many kind of contacts in that space. But COVID, you know, was a great leveler in many ways, especially for capital and fundraising. So, you know, before COVID, and obviously COVID, horrific, all those kind of elements. But, you know, if like a Zoom call is the same anywhere in the world now, right? And so all of a sudden, after you have VCs not expecting you to be 10 minutes on the road in the Bay Area, yeah, they'll get on a Zoom call. And I think that flattening is quite interesting. The other thing is, like, you have to kind of think about it, you know, like, what kind of company are you building? And is it the kind of company that needs traction? So if you are in a kind of hot new area that there's a lot of question marks, you do not need that much traction to raise money even at very early, like early stage. If you're trying to be the next Facebook, when you already have Facebook and Instagram and all those kind of things, you need tons of traction because it's a mature space. And I think that's like where people get, you know, tricked. You know, they'll often look at, and a lot of entrepreneurs I talk to and founders who are friends of mine, or, you know, people, a couple of people have started mentoring and so on, they'll look at a company that just raised, you know, $100 million, you know, and they're a unicorn, all this kind of thing. It's like, oh, you know, they are providing software for hairdressers. It's like, all right, I'm going to start a company providing, you know, software to, you know, rugby coaches, right? And it's, and I can go and ask because we have this kind of proof. It's like, no, this company is 8 years old. 8 years ago was the time to start looking for the software for rugby coaches and try to get VC backable, like VC, you know, without that much traction. To do it today, you need tons of traction because it's, you're 8 years further on. And so really, if you are a founder and you're interested in kind of being VC backable, you need to find out what the smallest checks being written today are and the types of companies that are getting those checks, not the big unicorns, because that's a distraction, because those companies are benefiting from investments a long time ago. And so that's the piece. The, you know, clean tech is super exciting. There's loads of money. I think, you know, I didn't come from a particularly, you know, wealthy background or anything, a small farm in Ireland, but I think a lot of the holdup for me in previous kind of companies I was involved in was just actually not even asking for capital, like not thinking I was good enough to be trusted with other people's money. And I wanted to try to break from that. So actually, like, just nearly as a psychological exercise, I started reaching out to VCs early, just so that when I did need their money, like, it wouldn't be this big kind of, you know, mental block. And again, I was surprised. I thought it'd be the hardest thing to find VCs and so on, but because the space is hot for VCs, it's very easy to get people on a call. Those calls, I'm never pitching. They already have my deck and we're just having a 20-minute chat, just asking them. I'm always being super kind of abundance mindset. So I'm offering to introduce them to other people in the space. How can I help you? Like, all those kind of things. Because again, I don't have a strong ask for them today, but, you know, when I raise money in 3 or 6 months, whatever it may be, you know, they've had some of them, like, 9 months of relationship with me, like monthly check-ins, all those kind of things. And so, you know, if you need money to get started, it has to be a cool, new, sexy space. If you like to even get started, and you need a VC from the beginning, you know, again, don't be the software for rugby managers or hairdressers. You have to be doing something that is high tech, new industry, you know, crypto. Think of crypto 2 years ago, right? Like 3 years ago, that you could get money without much there because nobody knew much about it and who knew how it developed. Mm. I suppose what's like that today. So VR is a little bit like that, and AR stuff, although that goes in cycles. Anything in climate, I think, is pretty exciting right now if you want to, and like really cool machine learning applications as well. If you're just building a cool software tool for HR departments, you have to get 200 HR departments to use it before you're going to get that much cool. It's just a factor, and you should know that going in, and I think that's completely fine. And bootstrapping, like, if I wasn't trying to do a climate thing, I'd be bootstrapping, because that's honestly, if you want to actually build wealth for yourself personally, bootstrapping is way more likely to make you a millionaire than VC backable, where, you know, best case scenario, well, sorry, statistically, like, you're not going to be a billionaire. You're going to have a small exit because you get acquired by some big company at best, you know, and you have to make those trade-offs.
So just explain that last point a minute. So you think there's more wealth to be made in terms of actually not going down the VC route? Just talk about that a bit more. That's quite interesting.
Yeah. So the there's a book called Founders' Dilemmas. It's a really good book. I think it's worthwhile for any founder to have it's about finding co-founders primarily, but it has a huge amount of research about like the kind of companies, tech companies in particular, biotech companies that succeed and what the founding team looks like and so on. And it talks a lot about, you know, the trade-offs between control and wealth. And the more control you have over your company, the less wealthy statistically you will become when you're talking about a VC backable, right? Because in VC backable, you're trying to get the scale as much as possible. So you need to give up equity. If you try to make sure that you retain 85% of equity and you give away a little bit here and there and your employees aren't encouraged and so on, your company statistically will get less big than where you end up with only 7% by IPO, but you're a $1 billion company. And so you need to kind of have a think through, like, do you want to control? And that's completely legitimate, like, view. Like, I want to, this is my baby. Like, I want to own this company forever. And, you know, this is what I'm working on. But the size of the company is not going to be as big. In the kind of what they call lifestyle business space, right? Where, you know, you own, you're never giving up equity. You're going to own 100%. You're not looking for that massive scale. You're not looking for a $1 billion company. You're more thinking, like, valuation is nearly irrelevant. You're thinking about revenue and cash flow. And so in my view, and I think the research backs this up, it's a lot easier to get to a million recurring revenue business, lifestyle business, where you own, after costs, you're making $250,000 a year into your own back pocket. I think that is a much easier business to build over 5 years than to get an outsized exit as a VC backable company where you own 7% of a $1 billion exit. Like, statistically, they're not even in the same category. Like, if you want to be somebody who's making $250,000 a year and have a, you know, million ARR business, I pretty much any founder who's already kind of can found things can get to that level. But very few people, because there's so much elements of luck to get to a $1 billion valuation unicorn type thing.
No, that's great. That's fantastic. Thanks for sharing that. So moving back to your business, where do you see it going now? What's your next goal, your next phase of development, of growth? What's the plans?
Yeah, so next, get that second paying client, finish out this pilot with the first, and on the basis of that, raise a little bit of capital, and get the technology moving on. Like, we're miles away from product market fit here. Like, we're still just de-risking certain parts of the business. So yeah, by April Fool's Day is my deadline to have, you know, over $1,000 MRR, at least 2 paying clients, and and at least enough signals to kind of raise kind of 400K to 600K range.
Fantastic, yeah. Fantastic. And when do you hope to do that? I missed that.
Broke up. April Fool's Day. So that is my kind of internal deadline, which is three months from now. So
fantastic. So that's when you're hoping to go out to the market and raise some capital. Exciting.
Exactly.
Exciting. Yep. No, but well, listen, thanks so much for joining me. It's been great, sure, to have you on board, James. I'd love to maybe sort of do this again and check in with you maybe. I don't know whether maybe just before you go for the VC rounds, like, you know, see how that planning's going and all the rest of it. That'd, sure, be great. Or maybe just after. But listen, I wish you all the best. Good luck with everything.
Yeah, no, very, very, you know, very grateful for the opportunity to chat and the great questions. And thanks very much, Ben.
Yeah, brilliant. All right, James, you take care, mate.
Cheers.